Major League Baseball, you could dream with no limits. You could become your hero.
Oh, he's done it again.
Steal the show. Or even start a new club. You could meet the moment and exceed the hype. You could write a new chapter of history and let your city dream of it. This is anything can happen.
One guy who had an amazing claim to fame in terms of drugs and sport. His name was Doc Ellis. And Doc Ellis did an incredible thing. The one person who knows, thank you. Doc Ellis pitched a no-hitter on LSD. Those who've taken LSD, tell the others how hard that might be. So what? If I took LSD, I'd be talking to every blade of grass like, sorry, sorry, sorry. To walk into a Major League Baseball stadium like, shh, 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 shh. The whole field is like, rrrr. Fuck, 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 shh, 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 shh. All the fans in the stadium like, ah. The umpire walks out, it's Shiva, Harmagadila, Harasasak, Harmagadila. Catcher steps out, instead of a mask, he's wearing a samurai mask, Halawada! Instead of a glove, it's a vagina. Come to daddy! Batter walks out. Instead of cleats, he's got hooves. Yes. Instead of a bat, it's a cobra. You walk out on the mound, even your gloves going, this is fucking weird. The ball. Yes, I love you. Let's do this. Do it, daddy. Do it. Pass the cobra. Into the vagina. For 9 fucking innings? Fuck me! It's like, what? He should have his own black light room at the Hall of Fame.
Welcome back to Hack Job. Today, we're with the Gilberts. Okay, guys, are you ready to see your new kitchen?
Let's go!
Take a look! Oh, here we go! It looks amazing!
You didn't do anything. You just put Bud Light on the counter.
Exactly! It totally opens it up. We gave it a fun vibe. Clearly, this is a room people want to hang out in.
It's the sure sign of a good time. Just right taste of Bud Light. Here we go.
The landscapers are here! Nice!
A can of Old Bay, a dock worker from Locust Point, a doctor from Sinai, a hairdresser from Patterson Park, and a firefighter from Glendon. There's a fourth grader from Friendship Academy, and a lacrosse star for Boys Latin, a Catholic priest, and an Orthodox rabbi, a grandma from Dundalk, and a drummer from Hamilton. What's inside a can of Old Bay? You are. Old Bay. For 75 years, it's been the can that connects us.
Jackie Robinson,
here it is.
Actually, could you read that?
I read your comments in our paper the last few days and wanted you to know how much I appreciate your courage and honesty. In my opinion, progress for today's players will only come from this kind of dedication. I'm sure also you know some of the possible consequences. The news media, while knowing full well you are right and honest, will use every means to get back at you. There will be times when you will ask yourself, is it worth it all? I can only say, Doc, it is. And even though you will want to yield in the long run, your own feeling about yourself will be most important. Try not to be left alone. Try to get more players to understand your views, and you will find great support. You have made a real contribution. I did appreciate what you have done. Continued success, Jackie Robinson. Oh, man. I've never really been like that. Oh, shit.
We'll be right back.
The next 2-2. Davis to left and will hit. Oh, my. It's gone. Santa Maria.
From high atop the Robinson Gearing Studio Complex, straight out of God's country, Pawleys Island, South Carolina, the Let's Talk Baseball Podcast Network proudly presents Backwards K Pod. And now, here's the host of the show, Jake Robinson.
I never move in slow-mo, welcome to my dojo. Those other pods are so-so, I'm chill like bro-yo. Focus like a GoPro, ripping up this promo. Check out the scoreboard, freaks are throwing no-no. Going, it's going, it's going to do its own. Your heart just stopped, cause Jake got strong and mighty. Undefeated, I mean it. Pull up the pod, scroll it down, then read it. Written, produced, directed, and mixed. Dog on your lips and Ozzy Smith back lips. Pick the chip, give me tip, get on to it. I got ridiculous pods without pausing it. You sit at home, cry like a girl, while I spread the gospel around the world. Yo, the pods are written behind tracks that mix it. Smooth with the groove to make ears wanna listen. Add a little butt and a rhythm to back it up. Another show to my name, now watch me stack them up. You think another white rap bag, but this ain't no act yet. My hobbies the rhymes, some people try to be black with that. Bell time, I come out, call the show. BKB, now let me turn it out. Yo, Nate Jacobs, Nate Porter, 71. Date, you know what time it is, I'm packing them guns. Yo, experience, I've been a witness to glory. And that's why I collect ball players and their stories. You heard? So, once again, back is the incredible, the pod animal, Jake the Snake Robinson, from the Let's Talk Baseball Podcast Network. I'm coming out of Pawleys Island, South Carolina. Half man, half podcast machine. Back in a caffeine cup chair. Shields down, photons up. Prepare to engage on this week's digital audio program that I call Backwards K Pod, where we collect ball players and their stories. What's cracking, seam heads? What's juicy? Welcome back into the dojo this week for chapter 130 of the Grassroots Baseball Podcast Show, spanning the globe. Backwards K Pod. I'm your host, the good Reverend Snake Robinson, standing on the mound with my choir of baseball angels, all the greats we have in our collection, the Splinter, the Babe, Say Hey Kid, the Iron Man, the Great One, Fenway Park, Polo Grounds, and back once again with another remarkable add to our collection of ball players and their stories. Hello, everybody. I got your hookup. Holler if you hear me. BKP is available on all platforms, Spotify, iHeart, Podbean, YouTube, TikTok, Apple, iTunes, you name it, I'm there. I'm all tangled up in the web, bruh. You can even tell Alexis to bend over, face down, ass up, and she'll play Backwards K Pod throughout your crib, which, sidebar freaks, it really freaks out my cats. And speaking of cats, I have my felonious feline of a co-host in studio with me today, Mr. Charlie Guns Robinson. And I see my young gunner setting up in the conductor's booth of our time travel seam diesel, ready to bend baseball space and time, tip the celestial scales, if you will, and take us on this week's leg of our baseball adventure. It really is amazing watching Gunner do his thing without the luxury of opposable thumbs. But he has given me the sign to load her up. The right ear is the indicator. The signs are hot. So with that, I want to get you last remaining stragglers here at Terrapin Station on board of our time travel on choo-choo. Kiss and hug your loved ones goodbye. For them, they'll see you upon return in a mere 2 minutes. For us, we're going to live out the life of one of baseball's most unforgettable characters in the game ever, Mr. Doc Ellis. As I look to the west of Terrapin Station, we see right down that left field line of our beautifully manicured jewel box of a baseball stadium, clear to home plate. We have a full house ready to watch our BKP9 go to work. The pitcher has completed his warm-up tosses. The catcher has gone down to second base. The infield is whipping that seat around the infield. And the umpires call play ball. And that is my cue to call all aboard. as I will now have Gunner set our time and destination for June 12, 1970, San Diego, California, Old Jack Murphy Stadium, where Pirates young stud pitcher Doc Ellis will do the impossible, and I do mean the impossible. He throws a no-hitter higher than a Georgia pine on lysergic acid diethylamine tartrate 25, better known as LSD or acid. So, hurry, hurry, step right up. Get in where you've been in. Take off your shoes, kick up your feet, open your kimonos. Ladies, take off your bras, put them away for later. Get yourself comfortable for the trip. We don't judge. As my boy Gunner picks up the necessary quantum speeds necessary to reach 1.6 gigahertz of RF frequency on our spectrum analyzer to create interdimensional wormholes and time portals to get us backwards in time to June 12, 1970. Let me give you a brief synopsis of the eternal Doc Edwards. And he was one of the best National League pitchers during the 70s, who ultimately feared success as much as he did failure. He was a dichotomy, lathered in layers of enigma. He both angered and amused foes and teammates alike. His antics cut across racial and cultural lines as a person who challenged the norms of the day and old prejudices he observed as a child of Jim Crow America. He had a very successful career, including a no-hitter we're going to address this week. He had a 19-win season, started an All-Star game, was a World Series champion in 1971 when his Pirates upset the Orioles in the World Series. He was a player rep as a Pirate, Yankee, Ranger, and even got a vote for the Hall of Fame. Yet, his claim to fame is, even though he was a successful hurler in his era, he admitted that he never pitched one game in his career without being high on drugs or alcohol. Around the hood, growing up, he was known as Peanut, and then simply as the Nut, because he was wild. He was a crazy child. Doc Philip Ellis Jr. was born in South Central Los Angeles, March 11, 1945. His father, Big Doc, worked in the local post office and as a longshoreman. He then went to school to learn shoe repair, and his wife, Naomi, would later assist him when they opened a shoe repair shop and a dry cleaner business. Doc Jr. attended the predominantly white Gardena High School in hopes of finding a better education, but what he found was a hostile dose of racial prejudice. And to avoid suspension when he got caught drinking or smoking weed, he agreed to try out for baseball. But he would find racial opposition and challenges there as well. He excelled at basketball as well, but as the only black player on the squad, he always felt like an oddity to his teammates and the school fans. When he is 18, Big Doc dies, and Junior decides to focus solely on baseball. And back then, he played a lot of center field. One day in a game, Doc hurls the ball from deep center field, misses the cutoff man, and literally throws the ball over the backstop behind home plate. Now, his coach watching is pissed. You know, he missed every cutoff man on the diamond, but he is marveling at the youngster's arm strength and decides to give him a shot as a pitcher. A tall, powerful kid, the 6'3", 195-pound freak who bats with both hands, became so strong and throws so hard that his friends eventually stopped playing catch with him. While attending Los Angeles Harvard College in Wilmington, California, he spends most of his formative years pitching for former Negro League star pitcher Chet Brewer. At this time, Brewer has been away from the game for some time and is now scouting for the Pittsburgh Pirates. And he's tutored many future MLB stars such as Bob Watson, Enos Cabell, Bobby Tolan, among others. Bruin would recommend Doc to the Buccos, and they signed the material right-handed pitcher in 1964, though his signing bonus was reduced from $60,000 to $2,500 after Doc's arrest for stealing a car. $60,000 in 1964 is worth about $600,000 in the 2024 economy today, while $2,000 is worth about $20,000. So he went from about $600,000 bonus to about $20,000. So that is quite a precipitous chunk of bonus money he lost there. And most of Doc's friends agree. Had he not found baseball, Doc would have been a straight-up gangster, and probably a good one. When Ellis started at the Pirates Class A team in Batavia, New York, he feels extreme pressure and the weight of the challenge to succeed and begins to dabble in drugs and alcohol. Despite his insecurities of failure and success, he excels, but soon becomes addicted to stimulants like benzodrine and dexamil, more commonly known as greenies, as they were made available in every single clubhouse across baseball back then. And he remembers he had an affinity for uppers because of the expectations to hurry up and make the major leagues. He was tagged as the can't-miss kid, and with that label comes a lot of stress and pressure. He carried a 41-31 record on his four-year tour through the Buccos farm system through 1967. He finally gets his big league shot when he makes his major league debut on June 18th at Forbes Field in Pittsburgh and relief duty in a game versus the Dodgers, pitching in the 10th, allowing no runs on one hit. On July 31st, in the second game of a twilight doubleheader at Crosley Field in the Queen City, Doc wins his first start versus the Reds, finishes the year in the 1969 Pirates starting rotation. In 1971, Ellis starts the season out strong. He is profiled as not only gifted in his overall tools and stuff, but he is highly intelligent. He is loud and garish in his appearance and attitude, and he's always looking for an edge over his opponents. He was known to show up at the park with a perm being sent by hair rollers all over his head. And while the rollers in his hair was a proud representation of the black culture of his day, Doc quickly learned he could lightly touch the ends of his curls with his forefinger and his thumb, and he could get stupid spin on the ball just from the moisture on his fingers and from the perm. And while such a look would trigger most people nowadays, baseball back then was still very much lily-white conservative and traditional. And the curler shot several of his Pirates teammates and his manager, Bill Burton. The skipper asked first baseman Bob Robertson to walk out to the bully and tell Doc to remove the hair curlers from his head, and Ellis refused. Meanwhile, back in New York City, Commissioner Bowie Kuhn did not appreciate the new Ellis hairdo, and he threatened to suspend and fine Doc if he persisted in showing up at Major League parks looking like Big Perm taking the bump. And Doc's perspective was, this is some double standard bullshit right here. I don't see you motherfuckers doing the directives at Joe Pepitone with his shoulder-length hairpiece, referencing the former Yankees first baseman outfielder who ran around the house that Ruth built with a dead squirrel on his head. At first, Doc intended to really stick to baseball and show up every day with bigger, louder, more obnoxious curls in his hair just to give Kuhn and Burton the finger. But he figures he doesn't even wear these things around the house. He's just doing it to juice the ball, and he better leave well alone and find another way to get his edge. Another two of his more controversial moments came in Cincinnati on May 2nd, 1972, after arriving at Riverfront Stadium to square up against the Reds. Ellis enters the park with teammates Willie Stargell and Reddy Steddett. when they are approached by Red Security and asked to present their IDs. Doc raises his hand, shows his World Series Championship ring, and says, "Here's my fucking ID." And the security guard, feeling threatened and seeing Doc raise his hand, he maces Ellis and he has him arrested. In the aftermath, Ellis threatened to sue the Reds organization, but the two teams, through Doc, they squelched the whole misunderstanding. The other moment came May 1st, 1974, on the heels of some Reds players making condescending remarks about the Pirates and their skill level in a Cincinnati newspaper. And when Doc reads the article, he's in the fucking red. At this flashpoint of baseball history, the Reds and Pirates are embroiled in an intense rivalry, and there's no love lost between the two respected organizations. To put it more eloquently, Doc can't stand these sons of bitches. There is no team he hates more than the Cincinnati Reds. And most of his teammates, they dismiss the smack talk as nothing more than fake bravado, selling tickets. But to Doc, he shows up at the park and he's pissed off and he's got a plan. In the first inning, he faces the top of the order, which is Pete Rose, Joe Morgan, and Dan Dreesen. And Doc couldn't stand Pete Rose. So the first pitch of the game, wham, right in his fat ass, as Doc would say when telling this story. Rose, to his credit, he pitched the ball up off the ground and he flips it back to Ellis with a smile on his face, letting him know, that ain't shit. I will gladly accept the bump in my OBP. And he doesn't even say nothing. He just looks at him with a wry grin. That wry Pete Rose grin, right? By now, the Reds dugout is chirping and in a heightened state of alarm. Johnny Bench tells Morgan, "You better be careful up there, Joe." To which Morgan retorts back, "He ain't gonna hit me, we're brothers." And Doc is staring a hole through Rose's forehead at first base, who is still smiling at Ellis. Doc is good and pissed off. The second pitch of the game, bam! Morgan gets plunked. The Reds are now getting loud with protests from the dugout steps. Big Dan Dreesen, get your monkey ass in here. You can get it too. Whammo! He plugs Dreesen. Bases drunk on Redlands. Top of the first. Bottom of the first. Let's go, big doggy Tony Perez. I'll hit your ass too. Unfortunately, or maybe I should say fortunately, Ellis would always say it's really hard to hit someone when they know you're trying to fucking hit them. Perez dodges two baseballs behind his head to walk in a run. And by now, it's apparent that this is a planned and deliberate attack against the Big Red Machine. The Reds are getting pissed off. His teammates are in shock and awe. Bucco's manager, Danny Murtaugh, is beside himself with anger and embarrassment and horror. And home plate umpire Jerry Dale was giving Ellis all the leash he needed to hang himself. After dodgeball misses directed at Johnny Bench, Murtaugh jumps up from the pine and furiously takes Doc out of the game. And for a player who could be known to seek out conflict, his rampage against the Reds was a low point in his career. Now, his career year, he comes out the gate white hot on July 6, 1971. He is 14-3 with a 2.11 ERA, all the way to earning his first and only All-Star selection in his career. After American League All-Star team manager Earl Weaver announced that Vida Blue would start for the AL Midsummer Classic, Doc challenged the baseball establishment and the racial preference of baseball when he went on the record saying they'll never start a brother against another brother in the All-Star game. Soon after, Sparky Anderson chose Doc Ellis to start for the National League, saying he chose him because of his outstanding numbers and he was on 6 days rest. Which was true, all those things Sparky said, but Ellis and many others believe he put the onus on Sparky with reverse psychology, to ensure the historical outcome that came of it. Doc had street game savvy. He knew exactly what he was doing. He told them they wouldn't do it, so they had to do it. And he would often say that with a sly grin years later. He acquitted himself nicely in the first two innings, giving up only a single, but the wheels fall off in the third. Louis Aparicio leading off the inning with a single. Slugger Reggie Jackson batting for Vina Blue launches a two-run shot that bangs off the right center field light tower in Old Tiger Stadium, one of the most memorable and prodigious blasts in the history of the Midsummer Classic. I mean, Reggie absolutely melted that pitch. With two outs and two on, Frank Robinson splooges all over his lips with a three-run dong, putting an end to Doc's all-star appearance and hanging up with the L in the eventual 6-4 loss to the American League. Later that season, September 1st, in a game versus the Philadelphia Phillies, the Pittsburgh Pirates become the first team to start an all-black lineup using a combination of American and Latin players with Doc on the bump. Which the Buccos won 10-7, by the way, on the strength of the Pirates' top seven hitters in the lineup: Rennie Stennett, Gene Kleins, Roberto Clemente, Willie Stargell, Manny Sanguin, Dave Cash, and Al Oliver, going 13-for-25 with one home run by Sanguin and nine runs scored. Ellis's best friend on those Bucco teams were Manny Sanguin and Roberto Clemente. His first roommate on the team was Roberto Clemente. And Robbie helped the kid from South Central Los Angeles make the adjustment to his new profession. Clemente's tragic death in 1972 had had a profound impact forever on his psyche, and he was traumatized by the whole sort of tragedy. He then went on a violent rampage in his house, displacing his grief, anger, and confusion upon his wife Paula, and they would divorce soon thereafter. And whenever Roberto's name was brought up after that fateful New Year's Day, Doc would just shut down. He never recovered from losing his dear friend, and he would never utter his name again. When people asked him about Roberto, he would look that person in the eyes, and he could never find the words to express his sorrow and admiration for his icon. In many ways, Doc remained in denial about losing his dear friend for the rest of his life. Doc was a different breed of black ball players than the ones that came before him. Guys like Jackie, Willie Mays, Campanella, the Monty Irvins, and the Hank Aarons. Veteran guys besides Jackie, who kept their heads down, went about their business, and tried not to rock the boat by challenging the baseball establishment. Ellis was outgoing, proud of his black heritage, and quite verbose in his celebration of his Afrocentricities. The veteran black player in the leagues at that time, they looked at these young baseball players coming through now as the next step in the evolution of the black baseball player in the major leagues. While guys like Aaron and Irvin were not as gregarious in their personalities, they admired this new generation of cats for being outspoken. And Doc's prized possession was a handwritten letter sent to him by the originator, the pioneer, Jackie Robinson. In the letter, Jackie tells him how proud he is that Doc has taken the mantle and being the living art incarnate of the evolution of the black Major League Baseball player. And that was the letter you heard him read aloud at the beginning of the program when he breaks down and he cries. And here we are, C-Fans, ripping through that last anomalous wormhole and straight into June 1st, 1970 for Doc Ellis's LSD no-hitter game versus the San Diego Padres. And I tell you what, nerds, let's stick a pin in this story right here. When we return, we'll all be nestled into our seats at good old Jack Murphy Stadium here in beautiful San Diego. And we'll begin our autopsy on probably the most improbable no-hitter of all time. And that is, if you believe the legend to be true. So let me bring my boy Gunner off with the treats for a great first segment. Oh, he's been up in the booth drinking catnip tea since we left Terrapin. So I'm glad we got here in one piece, quite honestly. Let me gather my thoughts, set a course on how I'm going to break this game down, rip a couple of tubes, and hydrate. I see you C-Meds on the other side of the break. Please support the grassroots baseball sponsors that support your grassroots baseball podcast show. Labyrinth's hand cleaners, no more smelly hands. Be back, quit fast in a hurry. See you freaks on the dark side of the moon.
It was time to return to our regularly scheduled program.
Up into the air goes Tatis, and he robs him of a home run.
Walk-off grand slam by Bobby Witt Jr. What a play by Baez. Are you kidding me? A career-high 11 strikeouts, Justin Steele.
Y'all, this is Big Tex Gage Gina, executive producer of Backwards K Pod. In Texas, we do everything big. After football and golf, there's probably nothing I love more than going fishing and enjoying a good crawfish boil. The only thing I dislike about going fishing is the lingering odor it can leave on your hands afterwards. Well, the Fish and Hand Cleaner is an all-natural liquid soap perfect for overpowering fish and bait odors from your hands. I can't tell you how many times I've eaten steamed crabs, lobster, shrimp, crawfish, and then washed my hands with regular soap, only to touch my eyes half hour later, and my face begins to melt off due to the damn Cajun Old Bay spices. Well, we also have a hand cleaner, specifically formulated to use after eating shellfish and other seafoods. Perfect for cleaning spicy, smelly hands after a Texas-sized seafood feast. In these cases, don't settle for anything less than our crawfish hand cleaner, our crab hand cleaner, or the fishing hand cleaner. An ingenious trifecta of natural hand soaps developed and owned by a disabled Navy veteran. He and Jake have a true connection, as they were boot camp shipmates all the way back in 1989. So he is family, folks. And one thing we do here at the Let's Talk Baseball Podcast Network is look out for family. So you can support two grassroots companies by two former shipmate Navy vets. Crushing big bowls of shellfish or fishing on the banks of your favorite river while you listen to BKP. Sounds like a great day. You know, in fact, hey Mom, where are my poles? I'm gone fishing. There's also a buffalo wing hand cleaner in development as we speak. To check all of the incredible products of this great company, you can go to www.crawfishhandcleaner.com or call the home offices at 713-588-0290. That's 713-588-0290 to support the grassroots company that supports your grassroots podcast show. That's crawfishhandcleaner.com or 713-588-0290 to prepare for your summertime shellfish feast or that fishing trip you're planning. crawfishhandcleaner.com.
And the next thing I know, I'm waking up. And, you know, I go outside and I remember her saying, "You got a pitch today." I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "San Diego, you got a pitch." I said, "No, I pitched tomorrow." She says, "Oh, no, 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 look, look." And I said, "Well, what happened to yesterday?" Yeah, I was out there, you know, high as a Georgia bird, tripping on acid. We had a rookie on the team at that particular time named Dave Cash, and he sat next to me. And he kept saying after the first inning, he said, "You got a no-no going." I said, "Yeah, right."
So you didn't respond at the time. You were so wrapped up in the game. And then about a couple of minutes later, he came back. He said, "Dave, I still got a no-no going."
I could also feel the pressure from other players wanting to tell him to shut up, because I'm not supposed to say nothing if somebody's throwing a no-hitter because it was bad luck. Hit a couple guys. He was an ugly no-hitter. I got letters about it. But it was a no-no.
Everybody in my
started ringing and calling Paula, the news media, and we're like, what?
I called him, "Hey, Doc, you did a hell of a job." He said, "What the hell I did?" I said, "What do you mean what you did?" "You know what you did. You pitched a no-hitter." He said, "Some no shit."
I was gone. I was in the wind. The party all night.
Study on who the hell Doc Ellis was. And this really isn't like a Byron pod this week, but I wanted to give you an overall profile look at the character that we are dealing with this week. The man who insisted that every single game he ever pitched in the majors, he was under the influence, whether it be cocaine, marijuana, alcohol, Bennies or Greenies, and many times a combination of all these things. And this week, we will be discussing the no-hitter he tossed at the San Diego Padres while tripping balls on windowpane blotter acid on June 2nd, 1970 at Jack Murphy Stadium. And our 3 years of collecting ballplayers and their stories here at BKP, we examined many historical accomplishments that strains our imagination and forces us to rethink the limits of human potential. Whether it's Babe Ruth's called shot, the 1932 World Series, Reggie Jackson dropping three home runs on three swings in the 1977 World Series, or Nolan Ryan throwing a no-hitter in his 40s. If it can be imagined, it can be done. But none of those myths compare with the unthinkable feat that played out that night at the Murph over five decades ago when a 25-year-old right-hander threw his LSD no-no. And like Robin Williams said in the clip at the beginning of the show this week, those of you that have taken acid, please explain to the ones who haven't how fucking hard that is to do. And to be fair, this wasn't your traditional no-hitter. Doc would always joke, I know it was ugly, I received many letters about it. He recorded more walks than strikeouts, 8-6. He hit a batter, saw three Padres steal second base, was bailed out by highlight web gems by second baseman Bill Mazeroski and center fielder Matty Alou. And this isn't a story you're going to hear on a tour of Cooperstown or in most official baseball historical archives. To this day, Major League Baseball has only released snippets of this game to the public, and I'm not even sure footage of the game in its entirety even exists. And believe me, Frank, I did my due diligence this week, called in a few bammers, and I cannot find audio or video of the whole game anywhere. Yet, Ellis' account of his most unusual triumph has entered the realm between the facts and the apocryphal, where baseball's most indelible legends reside. And with a day off on Thursday, as the Pirates arrive in San Diego for their first West Coast trip of the season, Doc received permission from the club to go home to L.A. since the team had a day off before the start of the series. When the team lands in San Diego, he goes to the airport car rental spot, gets himself a whip, throws the luggage in his trunk, and he then reaches in his pocket, pulls out a cellophane baggie, and he pulls a hit of powerful windowpane blotter out of the baggie, and he drops it. Now, before setting off on his short journey home, and he knew exactly when the acid would hit him, Doc couldn't wait to get back home, and sure enough, it starts to hit him around the time he rolls into South Central. And just as he expected, by the time he gets to his friend's house, he's smacked. He's beginning to peek. The dude's girlfriend asks him, "What the hell's wrong with you?" To which he replied, "I'm high as a Georgia pine." The old friends began partying and reminiscing, and they're partaking in copious amounts of booze and weed, and he and his friend did even more LSD. When Doc awakens from what he thought was a catnap, the sun cascading through the window of the woman's bedroom he ended up with, thinking it was still Thursday, Doc takes another hit of acid as soon as he wakes up, gathers himself, and walks outside to speak with the woman. And the woman is clutching a newspaper and has a noticeable look of concern on her face. She said she was getting worried because she knew he had to pitch today. And Doc says, "Nah, I pitch tomorrow." She says, "No, babe, look at today's newspaper." And sure enough, there it was, black and white. And Ellis is beginning to feel lightheaded from the acid he just took, and he's trying to process his confusion. Not only were the Pirates scheduled to play a doubleheader that day, but Doc was scheduled to pitch game one. He looks at his watch. Oh, fuck, that's 4 hours from now in a different city. He looks at the woman and says, "What the hell happened to yesterday?" The time was 2 o'clock p.m. He hurriedly jumps into a car with the woman who drives him to LAX. And she's tripping herself. He purchased a $9.50 one-way ticket to San Diego for a 3:30 flight. Which, sidebar, that's a great price, right? You know, granted, $9.50 in 1970 is worth around $70 today, but still, that's a damn good price. But I digress. The flight is at 3:30. It takes an hour to get to San Diego. He rushes to the MERP, getting there in time for his start. And once in the clubhouse, he immediately begins looking for amphetamines, which again were commonly found in clubhouses during those days. Doc would often use the amphetamines to help himself out after, you know, these drug-induced benders. Although he had pitched up many times, he had never taken them out tripping balls on LSD. He found some greenies, some Dexamel, but that needed a sidekick, so he grabbed a few bennies and swallowed them down with the greenies. And he knew the combination of the two, as, you know, wasn't very healthy or safe, but he's geeking at this point. He needs to somehow land this lethargic spaceship to the ground that he's on. And if not landed, at least get it to descend into the Earth's stratosphere. He puts a wad of gum in his mouth that he shoots so viciously during the game, he said the gum was turning into dust from the gnashing of his teeth. He looks at his catcher that day, Jerry May, who was usually the team's backup, but because of the doubleheader, he's getting the start in game one. And Ellis can remember thinking, this poor guy, I hope he can keep up. I have no idea how this is going to play out. He's gnawing the gum in his mouth, and he thinks to himself, eh, we'll be fine. They caught my debut. He was here when I struck out 13 Cubs on April 9th. And before we enjoy the game here at the Merv, it's important to add some context here. Neither one of these teams started the season out particularly well. The Fathers were 26-35 in their second season of existence. The talented Pirates, meanwhile, were getting onto a slow 28-29 start, and this was a chance to get back to .500 with their talented 25-year-old ace in his third season standing atop the bump. At the top of the first, Pryor is ready to pitcher Dave Roberts takes the mound. 6'3", 25-year-old hurler, who also cut his teeth in the Bucco's farm system. In fact, he and Doc had been roommates for the AAA Columbus Jets back in 1967 and 1968. And Roberts was shuttled between the rotation and the bully before he went to the Padres in 1969. Though the Pirates boasted a powerful lineup, Roberts breezed through Matty Alou, Gene Alley, and Roberto Clemente 1-2-3 in the first. And Doc comes out wild the bottom half. He swears he couldn't see hitters, only their silhouettes on the right and left side of the dish. He was having a hard time seeing the catcher. And after measuring this to the catcher, Jerry May, the intuitive backstop there, he wrapped his fingers in reflective tape. His two walks in the first were not unusual. Padres third baseman Steve Hunts was a walk specialist, finishing in the NL top 10 in walks per paid appearances that year. His other free pass was issued to San Diego's first superstar, slugger Nate Culver. With two runners on, Doc strikes out Ollie Brown to wiggle off the hook in the first inning. In the top of the second, Ellis was watching the trails come up on Willie Stargell's windmill approach to the batter's box, and then he hits a solo shot over the right field fence for a 1-0 Buccos lead. And Doc, buoyed by that Stargell blast, he set the Fathers down in order in the bottom of the second, though the second out came from a running, nice little running snag by the nimble center fielder, Matty Alou. Doc, a switch hitter who couldn't hit water if he fell out of a boat on either side of the plate, leads off the third. And I can only imagine watching a Major League fastball whiz by you is terrifying enough, but on windowpane blotter, I mean, that shit had to be interstellar, kid. Ellis quickly strikes out. In the bottom of third, Doc walked Hunts again, but then gets his first swinging strikeout in the form of Al Ferrara for the third out. Meanwhile, Roberts is in the zone himself, striking out Clemente and Stargell, and he now has 5 strikeouts under his belt. Doc comes out of the bottom half, hot as well. He strikes out the first 2 Padres he faces, but then he hits Ivan Morel with a pitch sending him to first. And hitting batters was not unusual for Ellis. He was second in the NL in hits, batmans, and intimidation was going to be a part of surviving this long, strange trip. It was simply just part of his game. He didn't have blazing heat, nor was he a painter. But players knew he was always on something stronger than Gunner's patented team and his questionable control. It instilled tactical fear in his opponents. Meanwhile, Morel realizes Doc isn't paying attention to him on purpose, so he's still second, where he would be stranded when Chris Cannizzaro popped out. And this is when second baseman Dave Cash and Doc began joking about the no-hitter to one another in the dugout, much to the horror of his superstitious teammates. But here was Cash and the Space Cadet talking about it aloud in the dugout after every inning. And Ellis struggles mightily in the bottom of the fifth. He is lit up like a Christmas tree. Occasionally, he remembers seeing Richard Nixon calling balls and strikes in the umpire's position. And the ball began to change size and weight in his hand like a ball of Play-Doh. At one point, Jimi Hendrix walks to the plate to face him swinging a guitar instead of a bat. He walks 2 batters again, first Dave Campbell, who also stole second from the oblivious Pirates pitcher, and then Hunts, who walked for the 3rd time. 2 runners are again on base when Al Ferrari hits a comebacker that Ellis gathered and threw on the first, a play he never had recollection of doing in the days and years after. In 1970, Jerry May was an exceptional catch and throw backup. He led all catchers in cutting down attempted base thefts. And conversely, the Padres had only stolen 3 bases twice that year in a game. The Pirates as a team had only allowed a 3-for-3 day on the base pass in 1 game that year, and this was the one. Nate Colbert, who was a thumper, not a speedster, had swiped only 2 bags in his other 155 games played that year, but after Ellis walked him again, he nabbed second from the distracted pitcher. He walks his 8th batter and 5 1/3 innings pitch, but he strikes out Tommy Dean to end the inning. Roberts was pitching the better technical game, but Stargell came up with another solo blast in the 7th to put Pittsburgh up 2-0. In the bottom half of the inning, Bill Mazeroski leapt to his right, making a backhanded airborne snag off a scorching line drive. Then Steve Hertz finally swung the bat, shooting a ground ball to first that Al Alber handled perfectly and then shoveled up to Ellis, who miraculously remembered to cover the bag at first. In the top of the 8th, Dave Roberts is lifted for a reliever, Ron Erbel. Which, okay, sidebar, folks. His name is Ron Erbel. Erbel in the LSD no-hitter game. I just think that's so funny. Erbel induces Doc into a ground out to end the inning. Matty Alou makes another great play in the bottom of the 8th as he chases down a dipping line drive for an out. He then walks Ollie Brown, his 9th base runner, 8 walks, 1 batter hit by a pitch, but no hits. Doc retires the next batter. After a quick top half of the 9th, the score remained 2-0, and Doc is still on the mound, looking to do the impossible. He quickly gets an out, and Padres manager Preston Gomez decided to shake things up by sending consecutive pinch hitters that Ellis had never seen before in the box. Pinch hitter Doc smashed the ball to Oliver first, who again shoveled on the ball to Doc covering for the 2nd out, which brought up Ed Spezia, one of San Diego's best hitters, to the plate. And he's pretty much the only thing that's standing between Doc and immortality here. Spezia is betting on Ellis' control and wildness. He kept the bat on his shoulder, pushing the count to 3-2. And with one last delivery, Ellis throws his most controlled pitch of the night, hitting that outside into the black and putting Spezio in the books with a no-hitter and a backwards K. Doc was ready for it again, but the team had to hurry back from the field for the second game of the doubleheader. Beat reporters found him unusually open during the post-game interview. According to Doc, he never pitched another game on lysergic acid on Thalamide Tarchak 25. He had his best season the following year when he started the All-Star and won the World Series versus the Orioles. He was traded to the Yankees in 1976, helped them reach the World Series, but fell short to his nemesis, Cincinnati Reds. He was shipped from team to team until finishing his career with the Pirates in 1979. Teammates again, Dave Robinson pitched in relief of Doc in his final start. But nothing in Doc's entire baseball career came close to the day he pitched the LSD no-no while in stratospheric orbit. Shortly before his death in 2008 from cirrhosis of the liver, Ellis sat down for an interview with NPR's Donnell Alexander and Nellie Allel for a final interview about the game. It was then produced and used for the award-winning short film called No No, a documentary, which I highly recommend if you haven't seen it yet. It's one of my favorite baseball documentaries. Sometime after his retirement, he got sober. He worked for the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections to rehabilitate black prisoners. He helped start the Black Athletes Foundation for sickle cell research. And he served as a coordinator of the anti-drug program in Los Angeles, California. And he would explain to the enrollees that he self-medicated to cope with the fear of losing and winning. He came to bemoan the feat that he's most associated with because, well, it robbed him of his greatest professional memory. And yet, Ellis's feat does endure as a myth of the American counterculture era. The sort of signpost that explains baseball's grip on the American psyche and the indelible way of marking our times. And for nothing else, it's just a crazy-ass story that I'm proud to add to our collection of ballplayers and their stories. And check it out, freaks. I'm going to call it right here. What a crazy-ass story. As we make our way out of Jack Murphy Stadium, Gunner is raring to get you all back to your loved ones, waiting patiently for your return to Terrapin Station 2024. As we load up our BKP time travel scene diesel, let's take one final look at those oh-so-lovely Doc Ellis stats he left behind on his Major League Baseball resume. Okay. Where are we at here? Where's those numbers I had? There we go. Doc Phillip Ellis, right-handed switch-hitting pitcher, born March 11, 1945 in Los Angeles, California. Died December 19, 2008, at the age of 63. He's buried in Inglewood Park Cemetery, Inglewood, California. Went to Gardena High School in Gardena, California. On June 18, 1968, he becomes the 12,704th man to join the MLB fraternity when he makes his Major League debut versus the Los Angeles Dodgers. Striking out one, allowing no runs on one hit, and picking up the win in relief. 12-year Major League career with the Pirates, Rangers, Yankees, Mets, and A's. 14.2 career wins above replacement. 138-119 win-loss record and a .537 winning percentage. 345 games, 317 of those games as a starter. 71 complete games, 14 career shutouts. 2,128 innings pitched, 2,067 hits surrendered, 958 runs allowed. He gave up 140 home runs, 1,136 strikeouts, 674 walks, 44 hits batsmen, 8,978 batters faced. 3.46 ERA, 3.37 FIP, 1.28 WHIP, and a 104 ERA plus. His slash against was 255, 313, 357, 670 OPS against, and a 279 batting average against with balls in play. 1971 NL All-Star pitcher, and he came in fourth that year for NL Cy Young voting. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, seamen of all ages, this is the story of Doc Ellis and the LSD no-hitter. That's cool. I'm glad to have Doc and his amazing game in our collection with a backwards K next to it. I hope you enjoyed the show as much as I enjoyed putting in the work and sharing it with you. And I promise, nerds, I'll try to be even better next week. I promise I will never charge you for the baseball content here at BKP. Information is power, and I want empowered seam heads in my circle. I'm just going to keep coming through every week with that free baseball smoke.
You don't want that smoke.
And I'm going to keep it consistent like Will the Thrill Clark. You can help out the show's growth and survival by leaving a rating review. I ain't stirred. I do what I do when I do it. No one does it better. Please share the show with your Seamhead buddies. Support the sponsors that support your grassroots baseball show, Budweiser, Old Bay, and of course, Laparose Hand Cleaners. Hit me up on TikTok and YouTube, yo, under that Backwards K banner. On Twitter, actually, you can find me at back_K_podcast. Or come into the Let's Talk Baseball Podcast Network private group room on Facebook and join the chaos. As my boy Charlie Guns is hauling ass down the tracks trying to get you home, I see the Doc Ellis LSD no-hitter getting smaller and smaller in my rearview mirror. So I now turn my attention to our Never Say Die baseball hydra. I reach under my kimono, I draw my katana sword, and I chop the head off that beast, only to see two more baseball topics appear in its place. And this week's going to be grueling. Counting today's show, I will be giving you three shows in the next 7 days. Our next show should be out Monday or Tuesday. It is the second annual BKP Managers Deadpool, a contest that runs throughout the season. And I'll be drawing names from a hat along with the current manager's name. And if that manager is the first to be fired, retired, or replaced for any reason permanently, then the winner will take home the trophy. Last year's winner was Adam Hebel, an educator in Baltimore, Maryland, by way of Philadelphia, PA. And he has the hardware to attest to it when Gabe Kapler of the Giants was the first manager in 2021 to lose his gig. I love the manager's death pool. Sounds like fun. See you guys there. So, I think I've accomplished my goals this week with the Doc Ellis story. Vinny Vassey. I came, I saw, I conquered. Parents, if you see your kids sitting on the couch like a bored AF, by all means, take those monkeys outside and play a game of catch. Thank y'all for coming out. God bless and win the day. And like my boy Shay Hillebrand told me in our 1-on-1 sparring session in the dojo a few years back, yeah, you go to hell, Andy Pettit. Me and my felonious feline of a co-host, Charlie Guns, we throwing up our Gunnar Henderson, y'all. That's our number twos. My boy is getting hot. Our number twos, as in peace. Manager's death pool. Next, y'all. See you on the flip. See ya.